From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, The Exchange goes in-depth with a special series on the impact of COVID-19 on our healthcare system. Each day, we'll examine a different aspect of how this pandemic has affected providers and patients, from telemedicine to insurance reform to the healthcare workforce. Today, we kick off our series with rural healthcare. Many hospitals and other rural providers were already in weak financial shape, and the coronavirus has only made this worse. We'll find out more this hour, along with ideas for adaptation and reform. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. If you live in a rural community, how has healthcare in your town been affected? What broader local impacts have you seen from the shifts in the healthcare sector? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And our guests are Tom Meese, CEO of North Country Healthcare, a nonprofit which includes four major rural providers: Weeks Medical Center, Androscoggin Valley Hospital, Upper Connecticut Valley Hospital, and North Country Home Health and Hospice Agency. Also with us, Kevin Donovan, President and CEO of LRG Healthcare, a nonprofit trust representing Lakes Region General Hospital, Franklin Regional Hospital, 22 affiliated medical practices and programs. Welcome, both of you. And boy, it has been a tumultuous 2 months for healthcare providers and healthcare leaders such as yourselves. Tom, to you first, how is morale at your institution?
You know, morale has been pretty good. And we are, we operate in Coos County, the largest and poorest county in the state of New Hampshire. And we have just shy of 1,000 FTEs amongst all four affiliates.
Full-time employees, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's full-time equivalents, correct. And we are fortunately one of the few employees that have been able to get through this without layoffs or involuntary furloughs. We find in the North Country, with an employee base that can be largely transient, that if we let people go, we don't get them back. Wow. So the day that we return to normal, we're suddenly coming back with 80% of a workforce at 100% demand, and that just doesn't work. So we've been able to contract our workforce by about 8% just by voluntary furloughs and people taking vacations and using their time off. And I think that has helped morale incredibly. Now, people are understandably scared. For the most part, there hasn't been an outbreak in Coos County. In fact, we've only had four positive cases in the entire county over the course of the last month. So, you know, the focus has been on being prepared for a surge. The more and more it looks like a surge isn't coming, I think people get kind of tired of sitting around and waiting. And people are anxious to get back to work. So when we started our return to operations program last week, I think people were very rejuvenated to finally put a date on an objective. This last 8 weeks, we haven't been able to put dates on anything. Yeah. So as fundamental as that sounds, that was one of the more tangible things we've been able to do for the workforce over the course of the last 2 months.
Well, uncertainty is hard, as we're all learning, no matter what field we're in. How about you, Kevin? How's morale at LRG Healthcare?
I'd say that, you know, it's very similar to what Tom experienced and talked about. So, you know, and you used the word uncertainty. And so there's a lot of uncertainty in our community and a lot of uncertainty related to our services. And I also, you know, I think it was Tom who used the word anxious. And I would say that our employees in our community are anxious for things to get back to normal. And, you know, I think that is consistent with the way probably most Americans and people in the world are feeling these days. Like, they just want things to go back to normal and get back to what they used to do. And I think that is what we're seeing. And, you know, we, unlike Tom's organization, we were forced to furlough and reduce hours for a large portion of the workforce. So we furloughed and reduced hours for approximately 42% of our workforce. And our workforce is about 1,200 full-time equivalents. And so that's about 1,500 people or so. So there were a lot of folks locally, a lot of our employees who were directly impacted economically by it from an employment perspective. And clearly there were a lot of people impacted locally in the fact that we are not providing as much health care as we were in the past, as we had to temporarily shut down the program.
Yeah.
So the word that probably most around here is anxious for things to get back to the way that they were.
Impacts definitely on staff and patients for sure. And just explain, Kevin, if you could, just remind us how this works. A lot of people, when they hear about layoffs or furloughs in the healthcare industry, they think, well, wait a minute, we're in the midst of a healthcare crisis. Why are you laying people off? So just, Kevin, remind us of sort of the financing and how that has had to happen.
Sure. Great question. I think that was probably the biggest question we had in the beginning when we furloughed folks. So, you know, going into the pandemic, we were probably one of the weaker financial healthcare institutions in the state of New Hampshire. As a result of that, we were, I believe, one of the first to implement a widespread shutdown of services and furlough of our employees. And so I think a lot of community members would ask the question of, wait a second, how can you shut down healthcare in the greatest pandemic that we've had in the last 75 to 100 years?
Right.
And, you know, what we remind people is that we, you know, while we exist to provide healthcare services to our community, and we exist as a nonprofit charitable organization, we still operate by some traditional business requirements that other businesses operate on. So we have revenue that comes in, and we need to balance that revenue with our expenses and make sure that we balance our checkbook just like anyone would balance their home checkbook. And as we were forced to close down services to both preserve personal protective equipment for good public health, social distancing, and because of the financial realities we have here in the Lakes and Three Rivers region as it relates to our healthcare institution, you know, as we closed down those programs, we saw that our revenue base dropped about 60%. So there was just no way for us to maintain 100% of our expense base if we were going to have 40% of our revenue. And we just didn't have any reserves to pick up the slack.
Yeah, Tom, can you talk about that too, this decision that you had to go through about how much to shut down, how much to leave open? Tom, how much did you restrict or stop appointments at your hospitals back in March? I mean, as you said, you've only had a couple COVID cases in Coos County.
Yeah, and that's really been the challenge, is that from a risk mitigation perspective, we've put into place is all of the steps that every other hospital in the U.S. has, and the canceling or rescheduling of all elective cases. If you were a patient in our hospital over the course of the last 6 weeks, it's because you had to be there. It wasn't because you were showing up for a lab, radiology, or x-ray. It's because you were acutely ill and had to be there. You know, one of the secrets of healthcare finance is that those procedures that I just spoke of, lab, radiology, elective procedures, joint replacements, that's the financial fuel that subsidizes everything else we do in the hospital setting. So we effectively walked away from more than half of our revenue while largely maintaining the majority of our expense base. In hospital finances, the majority of my expenses are fixed, buildings and equipment and things like that. I can scale down with people, but at the end of the day, I can't cover those fixed expenses. And we're an industry that meticulously budgets. And at the end of the month, generally, if I've got a negative variance of 1-2%, that's generally the difference between me being in the black or the green. And here we are in March and April seeing negative budget variances of 50, 60, and even 70%. And that flows directly to my bottom line. And we're seeing multi-million dollar losses in my hospitals as a result.
Wow. That's a lot of money, Tom. So how is it going now? You said you started to reopen recently. How much reopening have you done? Are the doors wide open to everybody now, or are you sort of selectively choosing what types of procedures you'll do at your hospitals, Tom?
No, we are most assuredly not open for everything, and we're following the guidelines as expressed by the governor and supported by the New Hampshire Hospital Association. So the patients that we're seeing now are those that might be harmed, for lack of a better term, if they're waiting on a CT or waiting on labs. In general terms, what we're seeing last week is that it was about 25% of pre-COVID levels. So while we've opened the gates, it's just a trickle so far, and that's by design. And then we'll match that against the public health metrics and decide whether a contraction is indicated or not. but so far, so good, at least in Coos County.
Wow. And Kevin, how about you? So Tom is back to 25% of pre-COVID levels. How's it looking for you, Kevin?
So we are just starting to bring some services back this week. And so we're mindful of the restrictions, and then the release of the restrictions the governor announced a couple of weeks ago. And so based on that communication, stay-at-home order 2.0, we started to plan to bring some services back and bring them back very slowly. So just this week, we are starting to bring back some of the physician and provider staff and limited staff in some of the surgical specialties which we provide to our community. And so examples of those would be ENT and general surgery and orthopedics and urology. So we're starting to bring back some staff in those clinics this week, which will then start to open up some time-sensitive surgical procedures being done next week. And so, you know, a lot of these folks are people who had surgery scheduled prior to the pandemic, and we had to put the procedure off. And so they've been anxious to get back and, you know, get those needs, healthcare needs taken care of, and then get on with their lives. So we will start that slowly this week and slowly next week. And then over the next month, we will start to bring back programs a little bit at a time. And that really is based on the fact that we want to be mindful of what I said before. We want to be mindful about our financial situation, but we also want to be mindful about seeing what happens with the pandemic. And we want to be mindful about our resources as it relates to personal protective equipment and other resources. So we're going to go slow. But back to my earlier comment about people being anxious to see things come back, you know, we're excited about this, the opportunity this week to bring anything back. And so it's an indicator that there is hope at the end of all this and that we are on a path to, you know, getting back to serving our community.
Well, and Kevin, Tom, oh, sounds like we've got some problem with the line there. Kevin, are you still with me?
I'm still here.
Okay, great. And Tom mentioned, you know, trying to make these decisions, letting people back who would have been harmed by, you know, continued delay in their care. What sorts of procedures or visits fit in that category for you, Kevin? I mean, is it a mammogram? Is it, you know, an annual physical? I mean, what sort of fits in that category and what does not?
Sure. So that's a great question, one that's hard to answer sometimes. And so, you know, when the governor and the commissioner of Health and Human Services announced that we could reopen time-sensitive care, you know, they used this graphic of a pyramid saying that the top of the pyramid are emergent services. And I think most people can define emergent, although, there's some ambiguity in there. But most people can define when they really need to get to the hospital, get to the emergency room, and need to be taken care of. And then at the bottom of the pyramid, there's this concept of elective care, where the majority of care is provided or needed. And those are things like annual wellness visits and checkups with your pediatrician and those types of things. And I think most people can pretty much easily define what that is. This concept of time-sensitive care in the middle is a little harder to define and really requires an individual discussion between the physician and the patient to understand, you know, what their health status is and understand what services can safely be provided and to understand what the risk is from their own personal perspective of not getting the service done or it potentially exposing themselves to COVID-19. So, you know, it's not a bright line, but there are lots of examples that we could talk about. So, you know, there are certain, to your point, there are certain diagnostic mammograms, for example, that might fit into that category. Or, you know, maybe a good example, one that, you know, we've talked about with some of our surgeons. So in our ambulatory surgery center, we partner with a local ophthalmology group who does a fair amount of cataract surgery in that ambulatory surgery center. And there were people who pre-COVID-19 got their first cataract done in one eye, and then they were going to come back the next week for the second cataract. Well, now they've been sitting here for, you know, a month and a half with one eye done, but not the other.
So oh, boy. Clearly, yeah. I can see definitely what you're talking about.
Category of time-sensitive care. And, well, you know, so when you walk through the examples, it makes sense. It really, it's almost a one-by-one basis, you got to think about it.
Well, and Tom, I'll ask you the same question. You know, time-sensitive care, what's really necessary and what isn't? You know, some people, maybe they're due for their colonoscopy. I mean, you know, people want to get those exams or those screenings so they can avoid a bad result or find something before it's too late, so to speak. So how are you, Tom, making those decisions about who to allow in and who to say, no, you got to still hold off? I'm kind of struck by Kevin's example, for example, of getting the procedure done in one eye and waiting for the other eye. So go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, you know, it's I know it sounds kind of fundamental, but my organization, we're not so large that we can't reach out to the physicians who originally referred the procedure that we then rescheduled. And that could be a lab, a diagnostic, an x-ray, or a surgery. So we're generally reaching out to those referring physicians. The primary care and the hospitals are very tightly integrated in Coos County. So it's a very narrow network that we can reach out to determine a priority list for patients who need to be seen. And it isn't necessarily one size fits all. There are patients that might need that mammography much more than others. There are patients that might need that colonoscopy much sooner than others. And you mentioned colonoscopy. It's a very high risk procedure under COVID in terms of the droplet precaution. So there are also procedures in and of themselves that either consume a high number of PPE that we are still keeping a close eye on the inventory, or still prevents a high risk for the provider or the patient.
That's interesting. And I do have to ask you, since you mentioned it, Tom, the supplies of PPE. So that's a factor as you make these decisions about, again, who to let in for a procedure and who not to let in?
Oh, Laura, it's something we look at every single day in terms of how many days supply of PPE do we have on hand and whether or not we need to retract the reopening process. 6 weeks ago, we wouldn't even be having this conversation because of the supply of PPE. Now we're beginning to see that come in a little bit more. We at the North Country have about 4 weeks, 4 week burn rate in the North Country, but one surge and that could be gone in a period of days. But that's, we look at that every single day.
Wow, I'm really struck by that. And after a short break, Kevin, I'll ask you that as well about how the personal protective equipment and continuing shortages have affected the decision-making that you're trying to make in the Lakes region. We'll start taking your questions and comments as well. Join us 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More on rural healthcare and how it's been affected by COVID-19 in just a moment. Stay with us.
NHPR is committed to covering breaking news and delving deeply into the details of what's happening in New Hampshire today and every day. And monthly contributions from listeners make this vital coverage possible. To each and every one of our sustaining members, thank you. Your ongoing support ensures NHPR can continue to be your trusted source of news. Become a sustaining member today for just $8 or $13 a month at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. All this week, The Exchange is going in-depth with a special series on COVID-19 and our healthcare system. Each day, we're going to examine a different aspect of how this pandemic has affected providers and patients, the delivery of care, and how it's paid for. And today, we're beginning with rural hospitals. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. What's your experience been with this? If you live in a rural community, how has your healthcare been affected? And what broader impacts has your town seen related to the struggles of your local hospital? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Tom Mee. He's CEO of North Country Healthcare, which includes Weeks Medical Center, Androscoggin Valley Hospital, Upper Connecticut Valley Hospital, and North Country Home and Health and Hospice Agency. Also with us, Kevin Donovan, President and CEO of LRG Healthcare in the Lakes region, and that includes Lakes Region General Hospital, Franklin Region Hospital, and more than 20 medical practices and programs. And Kevin, to you, just before the break, Tom was telling us that there is still a concern at his facilities about personal protective equipment and having to watch it really carefully, and that that is in part driving his decisions around what procedures and what patients to allow at this moment and what not to allow. How is it affecting you, Kevin?
It most definitely is having an impact on us. Every morning we have an incident command meeting where we go over key indicators for the day in terms of what we're going to do, what concerns we might have, the things we need to focus on. And every day in that meeting, we talk about the availability of personal protective equipment. And we talk about specific to the availability of N95 respirators, surgical masks, gowns, and face shields. And so our inventory, well, right now we've probably got about 2 weeks of N95s on hand. We've got about 6 weeks of surgical masks on hand. You know, the supplies are very limited, and they have been limited. Now, the supply chain's gotten a little better lately, so we feel comfortable opening up to time-limited care in a graduated fashion. But we definitely could not just open the floodgates and take care of patients today, because we would run out of PPE within days. And, you know, so we have to be very mindful about that and make sure that if we're going to provide care, we can do it so that our staff are safe and we can do it so that the patients are safe. And so that's why we're just being really thoughtful about how quickly we bring things back to make sure that we do have the resources.
I'm just really struck by that, Kevin. I mean, it's been 2 months and you still have to keep a daily watch on what you've got and say yes or no based on that.
That is correct. And, you know, it is much better now than it was about a month ago. I mean, it was scary. I mean, it's scary now, but it was scary about a month or so ago when we expected more of a surge of patients coming and we would look at the number of N95 respirators we had on a daily basis. And, you know, many organizations across this country have moved to reusing masks, cleaning masks, trying to use ultraviolet, light and cleaning to clean N95 respirators and other things. You know, we have not gone to that here, but those are the types of things that people are doing because there is not a sufficient supply of PPE across the country. And, you know, we've been fortunate, knock on wood, if you will, that the surge has not been as great in New Hampshire. And so, you know, we've been very fortunate that we haven't run out of PPE. But had we seen the surge like been seen in Massachusetts or New York, I think it would have been a much more dire situation in our state.
Well, I want to ask both of you about the rural aspect of what you do, because so far this picture that you're painting, you know, the financial impact of COVID cancellations at your facilities, the concerns about the shortage of equipment, this is a familiar story to everybody in healthcare across the state and across the country. And Tom, to you first, what's unique about the impact of this pandemic in terms of rural health providers?
Well, I think it's profound. And I think the listeners need to know that even pre-COVID, 51% of rural hospitals nationwide were losing money pre-COVID, hanging on by the skin of their teeth. Two of my affiliates pre-COVID were struggling financially going into this. Now we have this situation now where potentially a doomsday scenario if these revenues don't come back in the form of grants or actual patient revenue. But the other thing that makes rural healthcare very, very different than urban healthcare is that in each of the markets that we serve, at least in terms of the North Country, we're the largest employer in that entire community. And should one of these hospitals fail, you're talking about an entire community going down, not just that local healthcare enterprise.
Well, so, and I have heard, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, that rural hospitals have been closing around the country pre-COVID, as you said. Has that been the case in the North Country?
It has not been. We haven't, we have not seen closures in New Hampshire, but I can't remember the stat exactly, but it's something to the effect of 100 hospitals nationwide over the last 4 years have closed.
Wow. Okay. And how about you, Kevin? How would you answer that question? Again, most of the struggles that you guys have talked about are being, you know, observed and experienced in southern New Hampshire and central New Hampshire as well. What's different about doing this in a rural setting?
Right. Well, I think what's different about doing it in the rural setting is that, as Tom mentioned,
many of the rural hospitals across the United States are at great financial risk and were at great financial risk prior to the pandemic. And that is for a number of factors. That is the fact that we just don't provide the services that make money as much as some of the more urban, specialty-focused, large centers do. You know, examples of those things are like radiation oncology and, you know, cardiac surgery and those types of things that pay well. Small rural hospitals, we don't have the patient base, nor do we have the support staff to provide those types of services, nor can we afford the capital to supply them. So we are at a disadvantage financially going into, you know, the pandemic from just the types of services we provide. The services we provide are very needed locally, but they're not necessarily those that are reimbursed the greatest. So we were at risk prior to, and I would say that's common for rural hospitals. And you know, the number is that there have been hundreds of hospitals that have declared bankruptcy or closed over the last number of years. And we have seen that trend go even quicker with the pandemic. And so specific to our market, specific to our organization, when we made the hard decision to close down the majority of outpatient services, and we closed things down to a great extent, and as I mentioned, we furloughed over 40% of the workforce, we literally had a conversation at our board meeting where the discussion was, should we keep things the way they are for the next 4 weeks, and then we'll run out of money and close the doors permanently, or should we cut back services, you know, to a major effect and keep the doors open to at least treat the majority of people who are in our community who might need help with COVID-19 or emergencies. And so that was a literal discussion that our board had. And it was, you know, it was really that close in terms of thinking about losing the healthcare assets in our communities. And so, you know, where there have not been hospitals that have closed or gone bankrupt in New Hampshire for some time, if you just look around at states around us, you know, there are hospitals in Vermont, there are hospitals in Maine that have closed and or gone bankrupt in the last couple of years. And so I think people need to understand that we, you know, hospitals, not just ours, but others, you know, are at great risk financially in terms of having this happen in our rural community.
Wow. Well, again, our number for you to join us, Exchange listeners, is 1-800-892-6477. Again, today in the Exchange, we're looking at rural healthcare as we kick off our week-long series on COVID-19 and how it's affected New Hampshire's healthcare system. And right now, we'd like your experience or your questions with this issue of rural healthcare. If you live in a small town, how has your healthcare been affected by some of the struggles that our guests have described? And what broader impacts has your region seen related to what's been going on at your local hospital? Again, you can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And we got a question from a listener on our survey from Coos County, Deborah. And Tom, I'm going to throw this to you first. Deborah says she's worried about a surge. And both of you said you haven't had a surge in your areas yet. But Deborah writes, when things start opening up and people from southern New Hampshire start to come up here, we could have a bad situation, Deborah says. Are we going to have it or will we be free from it? Now, obviously, no one can answer that question definitively, but I wonder, Tom, what you and the people you work with are thinking about this. You seem to have escaped a surge so far, but Deborah's right. When things open up, people will start to move around and travel and possibly you'll have an increase in concern. So go ahead, Tom.
Sure. And Russ, a lot of this is my opinion and not necessarily coming out of NCH, but I think what we've learned about the major COVID surges is that they're in highly population dense areas and in urban regions. And on a nationwide basis, we haven't seen much of a surge in rural areas. And I think that comes right back to population density. And Coos County, during the course of the year, we have 18 people per square mile. So we've been social distancing our whole lives. To the extent that 18 grows in the summertime with tourism and travelers and just based on patient volumes, we know that we can see that density, you know, double over the course of a busy weekend. So I think that there is a legitimate concern that there would be a surge in the North Country, and we have to be diligent for it. I would predict that it would not look anything like what we've seen in Boston or New York, however. And to be clear, I don't envision a surge that would overwhelm the healthcare facilities in the North Country.
So you're thinking about it, preparing for it, but you don't think you're going to be overwhelmed, Tom. That seems to be what you're saying.
That's correct.
What about the Lakes region, Kevin? What's the picture right now in terms of COVID-19 infections? And what are you thinking about as the warm weather arrives? You got a lot of second homes in your area in the Lakes region, for example.
Right. So, you know, the Lakes region is a place that has a lot of tourism and a lot of second homes, as you referenced. And so we talk a lot about this in our communities, and there are a lot of people who are very concerned about it. And, you know, many of our, second homeowners come from, say, Massachusetts. And, you know, typically around Memorial Day, we start to see folks come up to their second homes and open up their second homes and get out on the lake and, and help our economy thrive locally from a tourism perspective and from a visiting perspective. And we greatly appreciate that. But now I think there are a lot of folks who are worried as they start to see people come up to their second homes and, you know, be out and about in the community because the COVID-19 pandemic has been felt to a greater extent in Massachusetts. You know, we started to see people from, away, if you will, coming up to their second homes, in late April or maybe even early April, which is pretty much unheard of. Because typically they wait till school's out and those types of things. So there's been a lot of concern about that. I wouldn't say that we have seen, though, a surge that has come from those people coming to the local area. So, again, if you think that we started to see this, people come to their second homes in April, when normally we might see them come at the end of May, you know, one would think that we would have seen a surge from that increased population, but we really haven't. I would say that our COVID-19 numbers over the last, say, 6 weeks have been relatively consistent. And so when the governor put in place stay-at-home order 2.0, it was because he and the epidemiologists felt like there was a stabilization of COVID-19 hospitalizations. And I would say that our rates have been pretty stable, even as our population has increased with visitors and people coming to their second home.
Well, Deborah, thank you for writing to the survey. And by the way, listeners, if you want to ask any questions or share your experiences with this pandemic, I encourage you to go to the survey, nhpr.org, and write to us there. Yeah, that's interesting to hear you say that, Kevin, because early on in this pandemic, the message from the state was to people from Massachusetts and New York and elsewhere, please don't come right now because our hospitals will not have the capacity to deal with you if there is a surge. You know, our hospitals are small and so forth. But it seems like right now, Kevin, you're feeling okay about those possibilities.
I would say we're feeling okay. I mean, I do have concern about opening up too fast. And it's less about people from Massachusetts or, you know, other states. And it's just more about social distancing. And I agree with what Tom said that, you know, in rural New Hampshire or in New Hampshire in general, you know, social distancing is what we kind of do on a daily basis in our normal lives. But I'm a little bit concerned that as people are getting, you know, weary of staying at home, as we start to open things up, that we could see, you know, less social distancing, which could lead to more spread of the virus and the disease. So I think we just have to be thoughtful. And I think that goes back to what hospitals are doing right now about saying, okay, COVID-19 is stable, so let's start to do a little bit more, but let's just go slow. And so I would say need to do the same thing across society.
Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477, our email exchange at nhpr.org. And both of you, a listener in Salisbury emailed to ask, has the rise of medical management groups taking over urban hospitals and physician practices contributed to the problems of smaller hospitals and practices? And thank you to that listener. And I did want to get into sort of the business aspect of this with both of you. Now, Tom, you're a nonprofit. So what do you think about the listener's question, first of all?
I'm not sure exactly what the listener is asking. I think that if we're talking about consolidation of many hospitals under the umbrella and things like that, I think that the risk there is losing the local culture and flavor as you're forced to adapt to a system level mandate. I'm not seeing a lot of that in this state, though.
How would you describe, Tom, the difference between being a for-profit and a nonprofit hospital system? You know, advantages and disadvantages there. Earlier, you and Kevin both described, you know, the thin thread that rural hospitals were hanging off of financially. So how would you describe the difference between for-profit and nonprofit, Tom?
Well, the mission becomes the same. I mean, at the end of the day, I still got to generate revenue instead of in excess of expenses to pay for people and equipment. The major difference is that none of my excess revenues are distributed to shareholders in the forms of dividends, and you can't buy stock in North Country Healthcare. So that's the major difference. But I wouldn't want people to think that a not-for-profit healthcare system means that we can operate in the red for years on end, because that's certainly not the case.
Do you have more financial flexibility, Tom, when you are a nonprofit? You can do fundraising and receive grants and so forth?
I think that in terms of grants, that the window is wider in a not-for-profit than it would be for a for-profit, for sure.
Kevin, how about you? What's the difference? How would you describe that to just your average person between being a for-profit or a nonprofit hospital system? And I should say, yours is also nonprofit.
Right. So we are a nonprofit charitable trust, and I'll be honest, I've only ever worked in nonprofit healthcare, so I've never worked in a for-profit setting. That being said, I have a lot of colleagues both in New Hampshire and across the country that work in for-profit healthcare settings, and I can tell you that they're worried and focused on the same exact things that we're worried and focused on every single day. And so that is making sure that, you know, we're providing good quality care, that we're serving our community regardless of our tax designation, and that we, like others have talked about and like I talked about before, that we are making sure that our revenues and our expenses balance. Now, of course, like Tom said, we do not have shareholders that are looking to earn dividends or some kind of return on investment, but we are looking to hopefully, although it's pretty hard these days, but hopefully create some kind of an operating margin that then lets us reinvest in healthcare in our community. You know, that is what I believe is a nice part of being a nonprofit healthcare organization, is that, you know, the money that we do make, if we ever do, which these days is not very often, but in theory, you know, that money gets reinvested back in the community.
Well, and coming up, I want to ask both of you about how you hope to use some of the state and federal money that has been going to the healthcare sector. Also, I'll be interested to hear how you are using telehealth at this point and other innovations that other healthcare providers are dipping into. All that's coming up, and we'll keep taking your calls and emails. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This week, The Exchange goes in depth with a special series on the impact of COVID-19 on our healthcare system, looking at patients, providers, the way care is delivered and paid for. Today, we're kicking it all off with how rural hospitals are faring. And Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. If you live in a rural community, how has this affected your town? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Tom Mee, CEO of North Country Healthcare, and Kevin Donovan, President and CEO of LRG Healthcare in the Lakes region. And both of you, I did want to ask you about the federal money, the state money that we hear is flowing to healthcare providers. And I think to you first, Tom, how much help have you received from the state so far? We heard early on, for example, I think about a $50 million grant to hospitals. How much of that have you seen?
Yeah, well, I haven't broken that down into detail quite yet. It was several million dollars from the state. The challenge with the stimulus funds, whether they're accelerated payments under Medicare or PPP under the Small Business Association, is that it still remains quite ambiguous in terms of what amount of those funds is going to be a grant to support services in the community and what portion of it is going to be a loan. And if it's a loan, when is it due and what is the interest rate? So I realize it's a very, very ambiguous and gray answer to your question, but it's a confusing time right now. So right now, and people need to also understand the healthcare revenue cycle. When the stimulus funds came in, when that cash came in for a healthcare entity that wasn't financially strapped, that money came too soon. We didn't need it yet. We're still getting paid for January and February dates of service. The stimulus funds came before we actually had that cash crunch. So until we've determined what is a grant and what is a loan, that money is just sitting in the bank for us right now. It hasn't been needed for operations.
Well, I actually appreciate the gray nature of your answer because it shows the reality, Tom, that it is confusing. What would make it a little bit easier for you or a little more helpful in terms of state money from the state or federal governments?
Well, I think we're going to need some clarity, and it's going to have to come from the state and federal level, that this amount of money that previously had been structured a loan is now a grant, or it's still a loan. And if it's a loan, this is the day and you need to start paying it back. We don't have those answers yet.
That's interesting. How about you, Kevin? The state, for example, pretty early on said, we've got this $50 million healthcare rescue fund. Have you received some help from that, Kevin, or what's the status for you?
We have. And back to our situation, our financial situation was a little more dire at the beginning of the pandemic. And so while we have received funds from both the state and the federal government, we have had the need to access those funds, or we wouldn't be here today providing the services that we're providing to our community. So, you know, the governor created early on a $50 million loan fund with the opportunity for the loans to be turned into grants to help keep the doors open at hospitals and other healthcare organizations. And, you know, you can hear him field questions on this on pretty much a daily basis at his press conferences. And we were, I believe, the first organization to access the $50 million loan fund. And we received a one-time loan of $5.25 million from that fund. And we did that in discussion with the governor and with his staff and his office because we felt like we would be closing our doors within short order if we did not have access to those funds. So
wow.
That 5.25, yeah.
That's pretty dire for your community.
That's very dire for our community and you know, scary from a perspective of thinking about what the community would do without healthcare and thinking about what they would do without us as the largest employer in the area. So very dire, and that's why the governor put that program in place. Now, we don't have clarity yet whether that $5.25 million will be a loan or whether it will be a grant. And that, you know, the loan documents, if you will, specifically state that it can be turned into a grant at the governor's discretion, and those are discussions that I'm sure we will have over time. In addition to that, we did get a fair amount of funding from the CARES Act that was passed at the federal level. And so there was about $100 billion that was originally provided to hospitals or was passed to be provided to hospitals. And then there was a subsequent $75 billion that was passed by Congress and then the president to provide more support for hospitals. My belief is of that total $175 billion that was approved, about $75 billion has been rolled out to hospitals across the country. Much of that funding has gone to hospitals who were either really affected by a surge of patients, so in the hot spots, if you will, like New York, or to hospitals that were in rural settings, like the organizations that we are. So, you know, we've been fortunate that we've received some funds from that, and we've used those funds and are using them on a daily basis to provide care. So we would not be here if it were not for the stimulus funds from both the state and from the federal government.
Wow, it's really interesting. I was also curious how much you are both using telehealth. And Tom, I'll turn to you first. We're going to do a whole show on this tomorrow, so you don't need to go into too much detail. But Tom, to you first, how much have your hospitals engaged in telehealth in the last 2 months?
Let me tell you, Laura, I'm biased, but there will be silver linings that come out of the COVID pandemic, and telehealth and the leverage of that technology will be one of them. If not for telehealth, there are thousands of patients that we're not able to reach during this pandemic. And we've been able to leverage that technology for office visits and specialty visits. And in some cases, and I'm speaking now, and specifically as it relates to our behavioral health population, we've actually seen higher compliance with medication regimens and keeping your scheduled appointments with telehealth. So I've got significant bias leveraging telehealth as a technology for the future. The concern, Laura, is that until recently, telehealth wasn't reimbursed. It wasn't reimbursed to the level we could cover our costs.
Right.
So on one hand, I've got this technology that is at least showing anecdotally to be superior for a select group of patients. But on the other hand, I can't afford to provide it. So earlier I talked about, you know, at some point we're going to need some governmental structure in terms of how telehealth is going to be distributed nationally, but it needs to be reimbursed in a manner so that hospitals can afford to provide it.
So just to clarify, Tom, so for now, the federal government has said, okay, providers using telehealth, you can bill us using Medicare and Medicaid for telehealth, but we're not sure if that's going to continue. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. And we're being reimbursed at a rate lower than if the patient were in one of our rural health clinics.
Interesting. And for you, especially, Tom, being so rural in Coos County, I think you said, would you say one person every 18 miles or 18 people every mile or something? Okay. I mean, just the fact that people don't have to get in their cars and drive 30 minutes, you know, for a quick appointment. It sounds like people are following up and keeping track of their medical needs better because all they have to do is sort of hook up online or on the phone.
Yeah, absolutely. And moreover, on a local level, we've been able to reach out to our affiliated FQHCs and our nursing homes, and via the deployment of iPads supplied by North Country, we're able to connect providers. You know, maybe we've got an ill elderly person in a nursing home. They're not sure they want to send her to the ER. So we arrange a Zoom visit from the nursing home to the ER physician in our community. They evaluate the patient, make it determined the patient doesn't need to come in. And that's one example of, you know, we've saved we've saved costs for the system and we've done the right thing for the patient.
Right, because for an elderly person who already isn't feeling well, just the process of getting in the ambulance and getting to the hospital, like that can hurt their health negatively. Kevin, I want to ask you about this too as well, but Tom, one more question for you on this. We do hear that good internet access can still be a challenge in the North Country. How much would you say that is the case? And if so, does that affect your ability to do telehealth?
Yeah, it's still a pretty big, our broadband coverage is still not where we'd like it to be. And there are some areas where the coverage is very, very difficult to come by. We're seeing improvements, but it's not where it needs to be for a full scale launch of telehealth as a legitimate service, healthcare delivery option.
Okay. Well, Kevin, I'm really curious how much you're using telehealth as well at LRG Healthcare in the Lakes region.
Sure. We're using it to a great extent, and I think it will have a profound impact on the delivery of healthcare moving forward. And, you know, I can think of many examples of patients who a quick 15-minute televisit is much more reasonable to do for both them and for the care delivery team. And, you know, so maybe it's a medication check for a child in our pediatric clinic. And, you know, that's a child who comes in on a regular basis and sees a pediatrician and has an established relationship, and they know them well, and they just need to make sure that, you know, okay, is everything going well? Medication's fine. I'll renew the prescription. And rather than having, you know, a mother or father take a child out of school, drive to the clinic, sit in the waiting room, you know, have the provider see them, and then, you know, go back. I mean, there's a lot of time there.
It is. Can, yeah, I've been there.
You know,
yeah.
That can be accomplished for some relatively routine things. Now, you know, I also believe that you cannot replace the physician-patient relationship and the fact that, you know, care providers, physicians, and NPs and PAs, you know, they need to place eyes and hands on patients to fully understand the situation. So you know, clearly I'm not saying that telehealth will replace the patient interaction, but I definitely think it can augment it. And I think it will have a huge impact. I, you know, from a non-patient care perspective, from telehealth, if you will, or from virtual working, you know, I think we're also going to see a huge impact on our workforce. And that, you know, there are certain things that we do that probably can be done remotely from a work-at-home setting or, you know, even, you know, for our organization where we have two hospitals and where we have multiple practice sites, you know, we still tended to rely on in-person meetings for things that probably didn't require it. And so I think that even from a operational kind of organizational perspective, we will keep using Zoom for meetings and teleconferences for meetings that we realize, why does somebody need to drive from Franklin to Laconia and then back from Laconia to Franklin, you know, waste a couple hours to go to a 30-minute meeting? And I just think that all of society is going to have a major impact from this. And you know, again, maybe it's the silver lining to a very tough and challenging situation.
Right. Well, we are planning a whole program on just working from home, how people are doing it now, and how, as you referenced, Kevin, we might continue, some of us, doing it in the future. So that's really interesting. Last questions for you both. And Tommy, you first, please. What keeps you up at night?
Oh, that's a good... It's, you know, as healthcare leaders, we're used to change. It's the one constant in what we do. But we're used to change at a measured pace, and our lives are being turned upside down over the last 8 weeks. And Laura, this isn't a you know, 2-3 month thing. I mean, this is going to change the way healthcare looks in 1 year and 5 years. So what keeps me awake at night is I'm going to be doing this for 14 more years. That's my career path, and I don't know what healthcare is going to look like in 5 years, and that keeps me awake at night.
I sometimes think I don't know how things are going to look in 5 days or 5 weeks, never mind 5 years, Tom. So I really appreciate what you're saying. How about you, Kevin? What keeps you up at night?
Yeah, things that keep me up at night are probably a little more close at hand, if you would. So, you know, I talk about our financial situation. So the things that keep me up at night are really balancing our financial needs in the very immediate future. And you know, the big concern for me right now, and there's a lot of them financially, but the big concern for me right now is how to bring back services when we have a revenue cycle, the way that financing works. And I know we've talked about this today, but it's, you know, we could provide service today, but we don't get paid for that service for 45 days or so. And so in order to provide that service, I need to bring back all the expense that goes along with it, staff and supplies and overhead. Yet I won't be paid for that for 45 days. So my concern is, how am I going to bring services back to our community, which are needed and we want to provide, but at the same time do it in a way that is fiscally responsible and able to do it. So, you know, I think that's the thing that it keeps me up most nights these nights.
Wow, numbers churning in your head at night, Kevin. I understand. And what, Kevin, is giving you some hope these days?
Yeah, I think, again, on a very micro level, what's giving me hope is that we have been working on a plan for our future for some time here in the Lakes region. And there's been a lot of question about that and what it's going to look like. And I'm feeling good about a plan that our board and our management team and our leadership has been putting in place. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that in the not too distant future, we will have a more sustainable plan that we can talk about that will take away some of these short-term concerns I have on things that keep me up at night. And not just me, but take away the concerns that our residents would have about, will there be a hospital in their local community, or will there be healthcare in their local community? And so what gives me hope is I'm really hopeful to be able to share more information on that in the coming weeks to months.
Wow. How about you, Tommy? What is making you feel hopeful?
Well, in mid-March, we activated Incident Command, which is a structure in which a hospital organization manages a mass casualty incident or crisis disaster. And it really brings the team and the system together. And even though we haven't fought the battle because of the lack of COVID cases up here, it feels like we have. And it's, we've learned a lot. There's going to be a lot of takeaways from COVID that will be applicable going forward. And like I said, healthcare is going to look different. And this situation is going to force us from a strategic perspective, look at how hospitals are going to look in 1 and 2 years. Will we need waiting room? Will new hospitals need to have that type of space? It's going to change everything we do.
Well, it's been really good to talk to both of you, and good luck as this whole issue proceeds. Tom Mee, it was really nice to talk to you. Thank you. That's Tom Mee, CEO of North Country Healthcare. Again, that includes 4 major rural providers: Weeks Medical Center, Androscoggin Valley Hospital, Upper Connecticut Valley Hospital, and North Country Home Health and Hospice Agency. And Kevin Donovan, good to talk to you too. Thank you for your time.
And thank you for having me.
It's Kevin Donovan, President and CEO of LRG Healthcare. That's a nonprofit charitable trust representing Lakes Region General Hospital, Franklin Regional Hospital, and 22 affiliated medical practices and services. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.